Hello and welcome to the New York Times podcast, your Klieg Light of fame. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
I'm the biggest hypocrite in 2015. Once I finish this, witnesses will convey just what I mean. Been feeling this way since I was 16. Came to my senses. You never liked this anyway. Your friendship, I meant it. I'm African-American. I'm African. I'm black as the moon. Heritage of a small village. Part of my residence. Came from the bottom of mankind. My hair is nappy. My d*** is big. My nose is round and wide. You hate me, don't you? You hate my people.
You've just been listening to The Black or the Berry, which is from Kendrick Lamar's second major label album, To Pimp a Butterfly. And I'm sitting here with Joe Coscarelli.
Hello.
We're going to be talking a little bit about Kendrick today. Joe spent some time with him a couple weeks ago. And we're going to talk about that. And then I wrote about the album a little bit after that. And Kendrick is at a very interesting moment right now. Joe, talk to me a little bit about the sort of setup in which you were spending time with him, kind of like what your top line read on his demeanor and mode was.
Sure. So the album had been announced only a week before and that it was going to come out on March 23rd, which ended up being...
Not false.
False. Even release dates are fake release dates these days.
It's great.
So I met him in the studio in Santa Monica out in California, where he recorded a lot of the album. It had recently been wrapped, and he was in a little bit of downtime before this rush of the release. We were in the place where the music was made, but he was past it, and he was sort of looking ahead to this big catharsis of having the world hear what he'd been working on since, you know, early 2013 after Good Kid, Mad City.
Was he anxious? Was he calm? Was he deliberate?
He was calm. He's a very calm man. His best friend and manager, who's known him since, you know, they were teenagers, said he's never seen him upset, compared him to Yoda, to Gandhi. And it's accurate. He comes in and he's serene. He's quiet. He's soft-spoken.
It's always striking to read descriptions of him or to hear descriptions of him in person, because I think it really, at least for me, it fixed an idea in my mind of what he would be like. And then I remember seeing him on the Yeezus tour a couple times, and he was the total opposite.
Right.
You know, on stage, he was so much bigger than himself. He was large and eating up huge. I felt like he was just like a beam of energy. That it felt almost completely opposite of what he projects in person, seemingly, and also what he projects on record.
Right.
And I think that different things.
I think that comes entirely through music. And that's just the place where he obviously works through all of these ideas that he has. I think, you know, he's probably an introvert in person, but he's constantly thinking and constantly plotting. And I think the way he inhabits characters on the record is sort of his vehicle for inhabiting this larger presence.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, like, his character work is different than, like, Nicki's character work.
Right.
Like, Nicki's character work is theatrical, it's comedic, there are oral punchlines.
Sure.
With him, they're literal battles. They're literal wars.
Right.
It's as if he's writing the character to attack himself.
Yes.
And that's something that he, you know, I think Sean Fennessy wrote something at Grantland that sort of touched on this a little bit. He can't have the conversation really with anybody else.
Sure.
So he has to have it with himself.
Yes. And his antagonists are in his head. They're his demons.
Mm-hmm.
He does that, you know, in a variety of ways, using different voices, different points of view in song. And it's almost always self-lacerating.
We're obviously in an age where rappers are sort of constantly calling themselves into question. You know, we're post-bluster in a way. But you have Drake's approach to that, which is like purely emotional and, like, frankly, sometimes very cynical. Kendrick's does not feel like that. Kendrick's feels, if not, it's explicitly political at times. But when it's not explicitly political, it's much darker. It's much more ground level foundational stuff. It's meaning stuff. It's not like, you made a bad choice. It's like, no, you may be like corrupt as an individual.
A lot of that comes from his faith and his Christianity and his belief that we're all sinners and that he wasn't the one who died on the cross. So he is carrying these weights of temptation, especially because of where and how he grew up in Compton.
The first thing, or the opening bit of your piece, you talk about him being baptized. How did he describe it? What are the terms that he used to talk about that moment?
So Good Kid, Mad City, his major label debut, tells this story of a kid being saved. And the top line read on that is that he was saved from a life of gangs through music because he had this talent, this skill, which you hear in a song like Backseat Freestyle, where his friends who are getting into trouble sort of take a break from causing chaos and say, show us how good you can rap.
Right.
And he does. And that elevates him out of Compton. But the other plot that's going on the same record is that he's being saved by Jesus Christ and by discovering religion, you know, following the deaths of a few of his close friends. Mm-hmm. And that to him is 100% biographical. And he spoke to me about how after one of his friends was killed as a teenager, another friend's grandmother came up to him and asked if he had accepted Jesus Christ as his savior. And he counts that moment as when he was saved. And that's the story that he's telling on Good Kid, Mad City. Mm-hmm. But once it was released and he didn't feel victorious, he felt like he had to take that faith even further. Mm-hmm. And that's when he got baptized. Mm-hmm.
And did he talk about that as sort of a process that, you know, did he undertake it with his friends, with his girlfriend? Like, was it sort of a bigger picture thing or was it just his own, like, personal path?
I think it's very solitary. Mm-hmm. I think he is a loner in that sense. And his friends are supportive and his family is supportive. And, you know, he says his parents, he grew up spiritual but not religious. And he undertook this struggle and walking down this particular path of his own accord. And he's pretty private about it.
Did he speak about Jesus when you were talking to him? Apart from saying, I got baptized, did he actually openly talk about faith?
He said that he believes he is a vessel for God's words. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, he told me that he's the closest thing to a preacher that a lot of kids have. And he feels that it's his responsibility as a rapper to spread this, both the goodness of, you know, the Bible and the word, but also the uglier side, the temptations, and acknowledging that we are all imperfect. And that's, I think that's sort of the driving message and the through line between Good Kid, Mad City and this album.
I'm sure you read Reggie Ogwu's piece on BuzzFeed, which sort of like started to tie the threads together about counter Christianity. And it's actually an interesting moment in the mainstream. You know, you have the success of someone like Lecrae, who has a Billboard top, I forget if it's top 10 or top 20 album. These themes becoming more widely heard, slightly tie into what you can start to see is a mild genre shift kind of away from the Drakes and the Waynes and sort of towards the Kendricks and the J. Coles of the world, things like that. There's a trite thing about in rap a lot of times where it's like your first album is, you know, everything you've experienced up until that point, and then your second album is your fame album. And it's kind of in a weird way where a lot of rappers get made or get broken because how you can successfully transition to rapping about this new subject matter and being convincing to the same people who cared about you before, that's what's going to get you the third or the fourth or the fifth album and those fans. So Kendrick's path is actually not that different from a lot of other rappers' paths, but the way that he's chosen to execute is obviously totally different. So Good Kid, Mad City is genuinely his life story. It is autobiographical or some simulacrum thereof. There's a lot of wrestling with fame on this album, on To Pimp a Butterfly. And this is a guy, I mean, look, a lot of people are out here being like, oh, it's hard being fan. You know, like, you know, just on some Drake, it's like, oh, man, it's a rough life. I wish I could just meet a cool girl. It's a lot of people talk about that struggle. But with Kendrick, you feel that the struggle is like extremely palpable. Like very, very palpable. Like here's a guy who is fighting to be successful in this world, and the spoils of that world are actually not the thing that he wants. That's not what the goal is. Success, but the goal is not with what comes with success. But yet he's still burdened by all that stuff.
To him, it's just more temptation, more success, more money, more women, drugs, alcohol, things that he wrestled with on the first album. Sure. Now they're more available to him. Mm-hmm. And
expected of him in a way. And this is a guy who seems pretty monastic when it comes down to it.
Definitely. Very, very minimal dresser, t-shirt, jeans, baseball hat.
Yes.
Very rarely with jewelry. But that doesn't mean he hasn't bought himself nice things. Mm-hmm. He lives in a condo not far from where he grew up, but presumably
it's nicer.
It's nicer.
You didn't get to see it, but we assume it's nicer.
And there was a moment at the studio when I was hanging out with him when we walked outside and I noticed that there was a very nice matte black Mercedes-Benz truck out mm-hmm. front. And I just assumed that it belonged to the most successful person in the vicinity. So I asked him and I said, is that your ride? And he sort of smiled. And I had seen him holding car keys earlier, but he said, no, I walked here.
Sure. We all walked here, Gedrick. Like, we all, everybody walked in a manner of speaking.
So he's very self-aware about this divide and about how he's trying to live a pure life, but also is now afforded luxuries that he coveted growing up.
Did he talk about wanting to make a record in any way that would undermine the fame part of this equation? Not the success part, but the fame part?
I think his idea was to make the fame part digestible to a wider audience. He mm-hmm. talked a lot about how he knew he was making a post-fame album because he can only write from his own experiences, but he had to make that palpable and digestible to a mainstream audience who's working a 9-to-5 job. I feel like his main struggle with that was making it relatable. And that's where I think you find him on the record returning home to sort of see the struggles that people he grew up with are still having. And he can then bridge that gap between his own self-doubt and insecurity with fame and the insecurities that young black men have growing up in Compton and trying to bridge that emotional plight.
Yeah, and that's definitely, I mean, as we were listening, hearing on The Black or the Berry coming in, I mean, these are, you know, Kendrick doesn't seem like a guy who hears a beat and then writes what goes to that beat. He seems like a guy who writes his verse and then figures out how to squeeze it into whatever the producers bring to him. It's interesting because the way that he writes is also segmented. We talked a little bit about characters before, but he writes in this very segmented way. And in the way that on the first album, or on the last album rather, don't want to short sell Section 80, Backseat Freestyle, to many people is like, oh, that's a cool rap song. But on the album serves this sort of very specific narrative function.
Right.
That almost... it's the opposite. It's the opposite of what the album's about.
He's in Backseat Freestyle, he's sort of undermining the idea of this tough rap song by saying, look at this guy showing off for his friends.
Right.
Look at this performance of manliness. And how silly is this?
Right, but you would never know. I mean, if you only encountered that on Hot 97, you would never know that it's commentary. But within the framework of the album, you understand it's a commentary. And there was an interesting thing that happened on this album as well with the first single, which is I, which we should listen to a little bit and then talk about how that functioned as an isolated track and then how it functioned on the album. And I love myself. Huh, I want you looking at me. Yeah. Tell me what you see. I love myself. I put a bullet in the back of the back of the head and a bullet. I love myself. Illuminated by the hand of God. Boy, don't seem shy. I love myself. One day at a time. They wanna say it's a war outside. Bomb in the street, gun in the hood, mob of police. Black on the corner with a line full of fiend and a bottle full of lean and a model on a scheme. These days of frustration keep y'all. Come to the front. Yeah, I duck these cold faces. Post up, feet, fight for faces. So that's I, and that's the album version. Now, there are two versions of this song. There was a single version, which came out a few months ago, and then there's the album version, which is seems like it's been re-recorded. It's been cleaned up a little bit. Made a little bit bigger in a way. When I first came out, and that was the first thing really that people had heard from Kendrick in advance of this album, I has this Isley Brothers sample that's like very, very light. And Kendrick's not a light guy. And it's very pro-self. It's very pro-black. But it's optimistic. And it's tempo. It has a real southern, up-tempo, southern soul and funk tempo.
And a little bit of gospel, even.
Yeah. Kendrick's an obscure dude. Like, you know, this is a very forward-facing gesture from a guy who's not a forward-facing dude. They changed it a little bit for the album, but obviously the most notable thing on the album is how it functions on the album. So talk a little bit about what it does on an album context as opposed to standing on its own.
So the initial reaction to I was probably more mixed than anything that Kendrick has done in years.
And vexed almost. Not even just mixed, but also just like, huh?
And the first instinct is he trying to go pop? Is he trying to make a radio single? Mm-hmm. When I put that question to him, he was defensive. He said, this is probably the best song I've ever written, and this is the one that will go down in history for me. And the other thing he said is, I made this song for Compton. I made this song for the ex-cons and the kids who don't want to hear about shooting and drug dealing. Mm-hmm. They want to get away from that. Mm-hmm. And the positivity there was dedicated directly to his neighborhood. So on the album, what you hear is him performing the song live in Compton for the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. That's the theatrical trappings of the album version. Now, it also works as catharsis and a turning point on the album, which up until then has been punishing, insecure, mm-hmm. full of self-doubt, mm-hmm. full of hate and uncertainty about how he's going to use his position as a famous, successful rapper. Mm-hmm. What he decides is that he has to go home to reconnect with his roots. And when he gets there, what he plays for them is I.
And again, this the agony, the sort of dominant agony on this album is how does a black artist serve a black community, especially in an environment where black life is being devalued and secondarily where black art is being diluted and mainstreamed. So this is sort of Kendrick's struggle, and like it may be a struggle that other artists maybe talk about over a dinner, but Kendrick's the only one making a record about it. And when you listen to I in that context, and I think you could have heard that on its own 4 or 5 months ago. But when you listen to I in that context, you really start thinking about sort of like optimistic 70s soul records. Like you see where his lineage is and what he wants to do, the stories that he wants to tell. But yeah, on the album, at least to my ears, it doesn't seem like this is the gesture that's the winning gesture, because it's one song amidst 15 or 16 songs. Most of the other records that he's making don't carry that. It may be what his dream is. It may be sort of like what the promised land, what his version of the promised land is, but it doesn't actually seem like the optimism wins on this record.
But there is a little bit of growth from I on in the track list. I feel like it's
from
a little bit
to the end of the record.
To the end of the record. Mm-hmm. It's the clouds parting and him deciding unity is what he needs to teach to mm-hmm. his community. And I think he says, you know, even if we're wearing different gang colors, we can still respect one another.
Sure.
And that's sort of the conclusion that he's coming to. And that leads into after I, the album closer, Mortal Man, where he invokes the spirit of Nelson Mandela mm-hmm.
and the voice of Tupac.
And the voice of Tupac and preaches this idea that the community needs to come together to fight this outside oppression, which shows no signs of abetting.
Yeah, and his version of unity, it's obviously very historically grounded. I mean, an interesting thing on this record is who are the guests? I mean, there's a couple of younger guests, but, you know, it's Dr. Dre, I mean, doing a bit of a spoken bit. It's Snoop doing a spoken bit. It's Pac coming from the grave.
George Clinton.
It's Kendrick directly writing himself into a lineage, a particular rap lineage. You know, maybe Drake was around last time, but Drake is not there this time, and I don't think will be. And I'm not even sure would know how to be on this record. Maybe he would, but I don't know. No one's asked him.
It's also a political lineage. You know, he's, in addition to Mandela, he's invoking Huey Newton. And mm-hmm. when we spoke, he said that his self-love and self-sustaining hopes for the black community are grounded in Black Panther thought, and that his parents used to play him speeches, you know, revolutionary black speeches from the 60s and 70s. And that's sort of the place that he's coming from and joining it with this legacy of soul and funk and gospel music.
And we're at an interesting time in hip hop. I mean, look, if we were having this conversation in 1997, there are probably 30 rappers who would have said some version of that in an interview. And we're probably at the place where only maybe 2 to 4 rappers, currently successful rappers, would ever say something like that. I'm always curious, like I've been curious about how Kendrick developed this fan base, because Kendrick obviously has a tremendous fan base in size and engagement who will take this record. They're not looking for it to be on the radio. They'll just take this record on its own terms. And his success reminds me somewhat of J. Cole's success. Although J. Cole has been, I think, much more openly trying to flirt with like being a mainstream rapper in the sense of being on the radio and kind of having songs that are oriented towards people who also listen to Lil Wayne and Drake and whatnot. But it verges on a silent majority in a weird way, because these are not songs that are heard necessarily on commercials or on Hot 97 or Power 106 or whatever, but a million people are probably going to buy this Kendrick Lamar album.
It's and very like, grassroots in that way. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it reminds me of maybe you mentioned 1997, like they're probably the same fans that were going to Roots concerts mm-hmm. at that time, but just, you know, almost 20 years younger right. at this point. And,
yeah.
and it's based in colleges. It's based in high mm-hmm. schools. It's based on the internet. And they've given a steady flow of work for many years that bubbled under. Before Good Kid, Mad City, Kendrick had a loyal fan base.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's also important. I mean, if we're going to talk about the 90s, I mean, you listen to Kendrick Lamar and, you know, you hear the Freestyle Fellowship. You hear the Good Life Cafe. I mean, you hear 20, 25 years of Los Angeles, experimental Los Angeles rappers who were doing things vocally that borrowed from jazz and borrowed from soul music in 1992 and 1991 that are miles ahead of what people are doing today. Kendrick is very much the children of those people. But it strikes me that, you know, we may have a year 2000, you know, we have a year 2015 where Kendrick may have the biggest selling rap album. J. Cole has sold out Madison Square Garden. And yet somehow the orientation of the genre is not, or it's not directed at those guys. It's directed at a Drake or a Wayne or Kid Ink.
Big Sean.
Yeah. So I wonder if there is a genuine gap that people are not understanding, that maybe the direction of rap is not what we all think the direction of rap is. Maybe the direction of rap is Kendrick and Cole. I wonder, did Kendrick talk about that at all? Did he sort of say like, it's my team? Like, was he aware of the weight that he carries, and not just for himself, but for what he can do for the genre as a whole?
I think he sees himself, again, a little bit as a loner in this mode. But I do think that he has a weight on his shoulders of attempting, as I wrote in my piece, to purify hip hop in a way. He mm-hmm. says, you know, I hear these songs on the radio about selling drugs and shooting people. And he was like, I love those songs. They're great songs, but they're not his experience. To him, he can only give you the good with the bad. And he thinks it's an important educational moment to say, this is one version of documenting street life, but let me give you the other side.
Sure. But I do wonder what it means for the genre, broadly speaking, if quietly that's the most popular guy in it. Everybody's gotten very comfortable. There's a lot of money going around. There's a lot of success going around. It's very, very easy to just sort of be like, everybody's winning. I don't want to think too hard about the shoulders and the backs that we stepped on in order to get to this place. But Kendrick doesn't allow people to do that. And what his success to me at least indicates is that there are a whole universe of dissenters, not people who don't like drugs. I'm sure they like what's on the radio. They like whatever on 97. But to them, they literally are craving the opposite. And for a long time, hip hop was holding, I think, those opposites side by side and saying, oh, you like NWA? We got NWA. You like Public Enemy? We got Public Enemy. They're both protest artists, but in different forms. And at a certain point, the sort of conscious stuff got culled. And like, in a weird way, used to get clowned at a certain point, like, you know, mid to late period Common, The Roots, et cetera, just gets clowned. Kendrick, I think, is the first person to really make a genuine argument for its sustainability and for its vitality.
And I think he knew that that space was open, and he felt like there was a void that he needed to fill. And he might not come out and tell you that he's filling that void. He's not really in the media like that. He's not going to be a Kanye. He's not going to be at every radio station telling you how important he is. But he knows that he's carrying that. I don't want to call it a backlash, but it's definitely a reaction to maybe what we've seen in the hip hop years where Rick Ross was on top of the game.
Right, exactly. And I wonder, I mean, I'm sort of interested now in like the post Kendrick, because, you know, to me, you know, Kendrick being able to do what he does, in a weird way, and I'm not given to saying great things about J. Cole, but like in a sense, he stands on J. Cole's shoulders. You know, J. Cole is very successful, but Kendrick does what J. Cole does to like the umpteenth degree, and like with a lot more delicateness and a lot more careful thought. But you kind of wonder about post Kendrick artists, and you wonder about if you're 16 right now, like, maybe you're OG Mago, maybe you're in Father, maybe you're into those guys, or maybe you're like, I'm going to become the new Kendrick. And what does that mean for Def Jam in 2018?
You see flashes of it in A Chance the Rapper.
Sure.
Where he comes from the same Chicago as Chief Keef, but mm-hmm. he's making a different kind of song that mm-hmm. wants to acknowledge sadness and fear and insecurity in a way that you might not get from a more mainstream artist.
Sure. Okay, then let's bring this to a bit of a close. Let's listen to a bit of You, which is the counterpart to I on the record. And unlike I, which is exuberant and self-loving, You it's like a rubber room therapy. I mean, it's really dark, and he's repeating ad nauseum, loving you is complicated. He's talking about himself. Like, he's not talking about his colleagues. He's not talking about his girlfriend. He's talking about him, and goes on and on. So let's listen to a little bit of You as we close out today.
I never liked you, forever despised you. I don't need you. The world don't need you. Don't let them deceive you. Numbers lie to your pride too. That's what dedication. Thought money would change you, made you more complacent. I hate you. I hope you embrace it. I swear, loving you is complicated. Loving you is complicated.
Thank you for listening to the New York Times Popcast. I've been your host, John Caramonica. Joe Coscarelli, thank you so much for joining me. You can read Joe and myself on Kendrick Lamar on nytimes.com/music. Subscribe to us on iTunes, listen to our Spotify playlist, and come mess with us next week.
Loving us is not complicated.
No, true story.
I've been recognized that you're ashamed of me. Yes, I hate you too.